Well, let us turn in our Bibles to the Gospel of Luke and chapter 20, Luke's Gospel and chapter 20. If you are visiting this morning, then please don't think that our congregation is this size every Sunday, because it's not. Unlike most church congregations in the UK, which can often become quite small during the month of August, our biggest congregations of the year are in the month of August. But come back in a week or two's time and you'll see a different picture. A different picture not only of the church, but also of the city. Because by that time, the city will be getting ready to welcome the arrival of the students at the end of September. And one of the practical consequences of those preparations is that if you live here, you won't be able to get a tradesman to do anything for you. And I say that because the next few weeks are a very busy period for the local tradesmen, and that is because most of the housing in the centre of Bangor is student housing, and so the landlords will be frantically trying to get their properties spick and span for their new tenants moving in. Their new tenants. You know what a tenant is, don't you? A tenant is someone who lives in a property belonging to someone else. And because the property belongs to someone else, that tenant has responsibilities or obligations towards the owner or landlord. And that is why tenancy agreements, and especially student tenancy agreements, can be quite long and complicated. Nothing is taken for granted. They include a long list of things you must not do and other things that you must do as a tenant, in addition to paying the rent, of course. For example, you must not keep your pet horse inside the property. You must ensure that the place is kept clean and tidy at all times. And if you think the rule about the horse wasn't very realistic, then believe me, the second one is even less realistic if it's a student house. But if tenancy agreements for a little terrace student house can be complicated, can you imagine what a tenancy agreement for a farm must be like? Did you know that a third of all farmers in the UK are tenant farmers? People who farm land that belongs to someone else. And included in their tenancy agreement will be all sorts of things, including where they have to keep the horse. There'll be all sorts of rules about the use of fertilizers and pesticides, the type of crops they can grow, and certain percentages of the crop or the profit from the crop going to the landowner, and so on. Which leads me to my first point this morning, and that is our desire to be owners rather than tenants. Our desire to be owners rather than tenants. Now, the previous chapter of Luke's Gospel records Jesus' arrival in the city of Jerusalem. Don't forget, from way back in chapter 9, verse 51, where we are told that Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem, Luke has been recording that journey of Jesus up to Jerusalem, his final journey up to Jerusalem before his death. Luke has been recording that from the end of chapter 9. And chapter 19 records his final arrival within the capital city. And by the end of that chapter, verse 45, we discover that one of the things Jesus did there was go to the temple and clear it out. He cleared it out of those who were selling all sorts of things. And having done that, he then proceeded to replace their commercial activities in the temple with, verse 47, his teaching activities in the temple. And we are told in the opening verse of chapter 20, one day as he was teaching the people in the temple courts and preaching the gospel, the chief priests and teachers of the law, together with the elders, came up to him and said, "Tell us, by what authority are you doing these things? Who gave you this authority?" He's only been in Jerusalem a matter of days, but during his short stay in Jerusalem, Jesus has demonstrated an exceptional type of authority. And it has got the backs of the religious leaders up, that's for sure. And it was within that context that Jesus told this parable, verse 9. A man planted a vineyard, rented it out to some farmers, and went away for a long time. Rather than a new build, as we would call it, this is a new plant. Apparently it could be 4 or 5 years before a newly planted vineyard would produce a substantial crop, which explains why the owner went away for a long time. But when the time came for the vineyard to produce the goods, the owner, verse 10, sent a servant to the tenants so that they would give him some of the fruit of the vineyard. Within the tenancy agreement, there would be a clause stating that the owner was entitled to get a certain amount of the fruit. After all, it was his vineyard, after all. And yet, when this servant arrived to collect it, verse 10, the tenants beat him, sent him away empty-handed. And so he sent another servant, verse 11, and a third servant, verse 12, but the tenants did the same thing. They beat up each one and sent them back empty-handed. And so having had three servants rejected and beat up, I don't know how many servants this man had, but it wasn't an endless supply. Having had three been rejected and beat up, the owner thought to himself, "I can't just go on like this. What shall I do?" Verse 13. "I know what I'll do. I will send my son, whom I love. Perhaps they will respect him." And what was the response of the tenants this time? Verse 14, "But when the tenants saw him, they talked the matter over. 'This is the heir,' they said. 'Let's kill him, and the inheritance, i.e. the vineyard, will be ours.'" That is the desire, to be owners rather than tenants. So they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. Now, as with all the previous parables we've looked at, it's important to remember the context in which Jesus told this one. He told this to an audience consisting of Jewish people, including Jewish religious leaders, and being people who knew their Old Testament scriptures fairly well, I suspect that some elements of this story would have rang a bell with these people. The little cogs would be going, and they'd be thinking, a vineyard. Yeah, that sounds remotely familiar. And I say that because this was not the first time they had heard about someone planting a vineyard but getting nothing from it. Several hundred years earlier, the prophet Isaiah wrote a song, and its opening lines went like this. We are not told what the tune was, so I won't sing it to you, but here were the words. Isaiah 5 verse 1, "I will sing for the one I love a song about his vineyard." Sounds really nice. "My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut out a wine press as well. He invested a lot in that vineyard. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes. Of course, that's what you're looking for if you go to the trouble of planting a vineyard, is it not? A crop of good grapes. That's what he looked for. But that's not what he got. But it yielded only bad fruit. And by the time you get to verse 7 of Isaiah chapter 5, you hear these words. In case you're not sure what that was all about, we're soon told in verse 7, "The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are the garden of his delight, and he looked for justice." That was some of the good fruit that he was looking for in these people. In his vineyard, he looked for justice, but all he saw was bloodshed. He looked for righteousness, but all he heard was cries of distress. It was a song about the people of Israel back in the 8th century BC, a song which highlighted their enormous privilege as the professing people of God in their day. To be called God's vineyard, to be called the garden of his delight. But at the same time, it was a song which highlighted their responsibility. Being his vineyard, they were supposed to produce fruit from God. Good fruit. But they didn't. And so it was a song which highlighted their failure as the privileged professing people of God. And picking up on the theme of a vineyard, Jesus tells this story in Luke chapter 20 to demonstrate that they're not any better after 800 years. They're still the same. In addition to sending them the prophet Isaiah, God had sent them numerous other prophets over the years, like those servants that had been sent in the story. God had sent numerous other servants to them. But they too were rejected and badly treated by the people of Israel. But then, just as the owner of the vineyard in the story went a step further than sending servants, do you remember the step further that he went? After having three servants beat up, what did he do? Who did he send? His son. Just as the owner of the vineyard in the story went a step further than sending servants, so God had gone a step further with this generation within Israel. God was now doing something even more remarkable than he had done in Isaiah's day or throughout Old Testament history. And that was, having sent several prophets in the past, God had now sent them in the person of Jesus Christ, his very own son. The son whom he loved, to use the language of verse 13 in the story. But if you're familiar with Luke's gospel, you will remember that it was also the language that God himself had used of Jesus on the occasion of his baptism. "This is my son, whom I love." And that is the one that God has now sent into the world. And therefore, that generation within Israel were the most privileged there had ever been. And yet, what was their response to the Son? Chapter 19, verse 47. "Every day he was teaching at the temple, but the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the leaders among the people were trying to kill him." Does that sound familiar? Sounds very similar to what happened in the parable, does it not? It was. And that is why we read at the close of verse 19 of chapter 20, "They knew he had spoken this parable against them." The similarities were too close to be a coincidence. He's telling them against it. They were the most privileged of any generation in the history of the nation of Israel, in that God had sent them not just a servant, but his son. And yet, like the tenants in the story, these religious leaders are planning to kill the son. And if you're familiar with the next few chapters of Luke's gospel, you'll know that is exactly what they did. Greatly privileged to have Jesus amongst them, and yet rejecting Jesus because, like the people in the story, they would rather be owners than tenants. Don't forget, as a tenant, you are living in someone else's property, and consequently, you have obligations towards them. You cannot do as you like as a tenant. As a tenant, you may have to use blue tack to put things up on the wall rather than use drawing pins. As a tenant, you have to accept the colour scheme that's there rather than create your own. As a tenant, you are accountable, and therefore you cannot do as you pleased. That was true of the privileged professing people of God in Isaiah's day. It was true of these people in Jesus' day. And there is a sense in which it is true of all of us today. I say that because there is a sense in which we are all tenants this morning. And on hearing that, you may be thinking to yourself, not only has he got their backup back then, he's got my backup this morning, because I'm not a tenant, I'll have you know. Well, I may have been 10 years ago when I was a student, but now I've bought my own place. I may have been 30 years ago, but I've paid off my mortgage, and so I'm no tenant. I own the place I live in, and therefore I can do as I please. If I want blue ceilings and green walls, I'll have blue ceilings and green walls. And even if I did want to keep my horse in the house, I could do that as well. It's my place, and therefore I'm answerable to no one, and I'll do what I want with it. And yes, if you own the house that you live in, then you are free to decorate it as you please. Have you ever thought whose world you live in? Have you ever thought whose world you live in? It's not your world. And it's not Donald Trump or Vladimir Putin's world either. It is God's world. Having created it in the first place and having sustained it every moment of every day, it is his. He is the rightful owner of the world he has made. You and I simply have the privilege of living in it. And therefore, you and I are tenants in God's world. But don't forget, being tenants in God's world means that you're accountable to God for how you live in his world. As the rightful owner, he has the authority to say what we can and cannot do as created beings within his creation. And did you know, the primary reason millions of people within our society this morning don't want to believe in a creator is not because the science overwhelmingly disproves the existence of one. That is just a smokescreen. It's because they don't want a creator who has the authority to tell them what they can and cannot do in life. They want to do what they want with their lives. They want to live it as they please. They want to be owners during their time in this world rather than tenants. And if that is you this morning, then can I remind you that you will never be an independent, freelance, autonomous owner as long as you are living in God's world. Living in God's world makes you a tenant, and therefore you have obligations. Moral, religious obligations towards Him. And you're accountable to Him, regardless of how much you wish it was otherwise. That is our desire, to be owners rather than tenants. But then I suspect that for most of us here this morning, or at least a lot of us, I suspect our privileges go much further than being a tenant in God's world. Most of us here this morning have probably known what it is to be associated to some extent at least, with God's, not only God's world, but God's vineyard, to use the language of Isaiah 5, in that we too have either grown up or spent time amongst the professing people of God, and consequently we have not only had the privilege of living in God's world, we have also had the privilege of hearing God's word. Like the people of Israel in Isaiah 5, and like the inhabitants of Jerusalem in Luke 20, we have heard what the Old Testament prophets have said. In addition to that privilege, we've also heard what the apostles of the New Testament have said. And what is more, we've not only heard from those servants of God about how we ought to live our lives as created beings in God's creation, we have also had the far greater privilege of hearing from those prophets and apostles about the forgiveness of sins and the salvation from the consequences of sin that is to be found in Jesus Christ. And can I just say that if you've never realized that the primary message of those biblical writers, both Old and New Testament, if you've never realized that their primary message is one of forgiveness and salvation through trusting in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, then you haven't understood them properly. And therefore, before dismissing their message, you need to go back and read them again and listen to them again, asking God to help you understand what their message was really all about. You don't want to miss their message. And I say that because the salvation that they are proclaiming throughout Old and New Testaments is a salvation which you and I desperately need this morning as a result of not living as we ought to within God's world. But if we have heard and understood what they were saying, then the big question is, how have we responded to those privileges, enormous privileges, that we've known? Have we made the most of them and believed the good news about Jesus Christ? Or have we, like the tenants in the story, rejected the Son? And why would we do that? You may be thinking to yourself, well, don't forget, the issue that gave rise to this parable being told in the first place was the issue of authority, wasn't it? Jesus was demonstrating not only an exceptional authority, but he was demonstrating a divine authority. And that is what angered those religious leaders back then. They thought that they were in charge of what went on within the nation of Israel, or at least within the city of Jerusalem, and certainly within the temple of Jerusalem. They thought they were in charge of what went on within the temple courts. In other words, they thought they were the owners rather than the tenants. But here comes Jesus, and he challenges their mistaken and assumed authority by telling them what they can and cannot do within the temple, and they don't like it, to the extent that they are planning to kill him. You see, just as people's rejection of the truth of a creator usually stems from a desire to evade his authority, so their rejection of Jesus was over the issue of authority. They didn't want him telling them what they could and could not do. And it may be that that is the issue that is preventing you from turning to Jesus Christ and trusting him for the forgiveness and for the salvation that you desperately need this morning. You've heard, and rightly so, that accepting Jesus as your Saviour means having him as your Lord and King. You've heard, and rightly so, that trusting in Jesus means turning from your sin and submitting to his rightful authority within your life. That is what the Bible teaches. But it may be that in spite of your enormous privileges of having heard all those things, true things, biblical things about Jesus, the Son of God, it may be that you're persisting in your rejection of him, because rather than being a tenant who has obligations to someone else, you want to remain the owner and the ruler and the master of your own little life. And if that is you this morning, then please listen to what Jesus went on to say in the remainder of the parable, because in the remainder of the parable we hear Jesus tell us about a future judgment on tenants who reject the Son. Now, contrary to what the landlord in the story had hoped for, the sending of his son didn't produce a massive change in the attitude of the tenants. Instead, it actually brought out the worst in them. It revealed just how bad they really were. It revealed how determined they were to obtain ownership of the vineyard. That's why we read in verse 14, when the tenants saw him, they talked the matter over. "This is the heir," they said. "Let's kill him and the inheritance will be ours." So they threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. The question now is, how is the landlord going to respond to this latest and greatest of insults? How is he going to respond? Please note, it's not just like if you've been in a tenancy agreement, you might have been a bit late with a week's rent. It's much more serious than that. They've killed his son, whom he loved. And so the question is, how is he going to respond? Is the landlord, on hearing that his son was killed, is the landlord just going to shrug his shoulders and say, "Ah, well, that's life. You win some and you lose some"? Is that how he's going to respond? Is the landlord going to remain indifferent towards such cruel and wicked and completely unjustified treatment of his own son? What then, verse 15, what then will the owner of the vineyard do to them? And the answer is verse 16. He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. And we are told in verse 16 that when the people heard this, they said, "May this never be." Is that how you respond to little stories? They said that Not because they had tremendous sympathy for the wicked and deceitful tenants in the story, but they said that because they were beginning to realise that the story was actually about them. Having rejected prophet after prophet, these Jewish leaders are already plotting the death of the Son whom God has sent. But what they are now hearing from the lips of Jesus is that God will not be indifferent to such treatment of his Son. Instead, he will respond to it in judgment. Those who treat his Son that way will be punished. And the privilege they have known will be given to others. Now, don't forget, he's speaking to a Jewish audience. And within that historical context, what that meant is that their great privileges would be given to non-Jewish people, to Gentile people like us. And if you read the book of Acts, you'll hear how that came about. But the tragedy this morning is that most Gentile people haven't responded to the coming of the Son any differently from the Jewish people before them. And that's why the warnings of judgment at the end of this story continue to be relevant to us today. Quoting the Old Testament book of Psalms, Psalm 118, Jesus says, "The stone the builders rejected has become the capstone. Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, but he on whom it falls will be crushed." Now don't forget, the psalm was written before the days of mass-produced concrete breeze blocks, which we use, most builders use today, and you get them you get them reasonably cheap. But buildings back then were built from natural stone. And builders back then selected each stone, each particular stone, to fit a particular space and to play a particular role in the construction of the building. Quite different from how we build today. But the picture here, if you can just imagine a big pile of individual stones, not house bricks, but individual stones, and the picture here is of one particular stone in the pile. It's never been selected. Because each time a builder picked it up and looked at it, he thought, not having that one. And so it was rejected. But then there came a time when that repeatedly rejected stone becomes the capstone or the cornerstone of the entire building. In other words, it becomes the most important stone in the whole building. And the point that Jesus is making is that although he was currently being rejected by religious leaders who saw no place for him in God's work in this world, that same one would become the most important person in God's dealings with this world. He is God's Son. And having died and risen again, he would be exalted to the place of supreme authority within our universe, a position that he continues to hold today. Although they saw no place for him within the temple of that day, they didn't think he even had a right to be there. Although they saw no place for him within the temple of that day, following his death and resurrection, he would become the most important stone, the chief cornerstone within the real permanent temple that building in Jerusalem was pointing forward to, as Paul reminds us in Ephesians chapter 2. And says Jesus in verse 18, "Everyone who falls on that stone will be broken to pieces, but he on whom it falls will be crushed." In other words, those who persistently ignore or reject this Jesus will one day be judged by him. Those who persistently see no place for Jesus in their life will one day be punished by him. That is the solemn warning that Jesus delivers here concerning future judgment on tenants who persistently reject the Son. Now, sadly, the Jewish leaders of that day never responded to that warning as they should have done. You would have thought that would have been a real wake-up call for them, would you have not? But they never responded as they ought to have done. Verse 19 tells us that in spite of the warning, they looked for a way to arrest him immediately because they knew he had spoken this parable against them. In other words, they persist in spite of the warning. They persist in their rejection of the Son. And in doing so, they would suffer the dreadful consequences that Jesus has spelt out here. That was their response back then to the Son whom God had sent into this world. And the question we need to ask this morning is, what is our response to him? What has our response to him been? In spite of men and women's persistent rejection of the revelation that God has given of himself in creation, God has sent his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ. He sent his Son, as we were reminded earlier in the service, to seek and to save those that are lost. He has sent his Son so that those who believe in him will not perish as they deserve to do, but will instead have eternal life. But the question we need to ask ourselves this morning is this: have we believed in the Son whom God has sent? Have we put our trust and our confidence in him to save us from the judgment which our previous rejection of God's revelation justly deserves? Have we? Or have we persisted in our rebellion towards our landlord to the extent that we've even refused and rejected his Son? If that is the case, then please remember the solemn warning that Jesus gives here about future judgment on those who reject the Son. Because don't forget, the Son you are rejecting has become the most important person in God's dealings with this world. He is the one that you're going to have to stand before on a future day and give an account. And your eternal future depends upon your attitude to him and your relationship to him in the present. And so, that being the case, don't do what they did back then. Having heard the warning, don't persist in your rejection of the Son. Instead, look to him and trust him. Put your confidence in him and give him the rightful place of authority within your life, which he rightly deserves. Because in doing so, you will have the great assurance of being with him for eternity. Two things we see in the parable of the tenants: our desire to be owners rather than tenants, but a future judgment on tenants who reject the Son.